All right, bismillah, alhamdulillah, wa salatu wa salamu ala rasulillah wa ala alihi wa sahbihi ajma'in. Amma ba'd, Allahumma alimna ma yanfa'una wa anfa'na bima alamtana wa zidna ilman wa amala. So this is week 3 of the life of the Prophet sallallahu alayhi wa sallam. And we're going to be covering a few topics. We're going to talk about the Quraysh. We're going to talk about how the Prophet was an orphan, how he was a shepherd, how he participated in a coalition to protect the weak. The type of reputation that he had throughout Mecca before he was a prophet, his marriage and family life before he was a prophet, the incident regarding rebuilding of the Kaaba, and the seclusion that he went into before he received revelation. Okay, so the Quraysh. Okay, we're talking about the 5th century CE. So in the 5th century CE, a man by the name of Qusay recaptured Mecca. So we were talking before about how the tribe of Khuza'a had kicked out the descendants of Prophet Ismail. And they were kicked out, and what ended up happening in the 5th century, Qusay, who is one of the descendants of Prophet Ismail, manages to recapture Mecca, and the descendants of Prophet Ismail are in control of the city once again. So that's important to understand, that the tribe of Quraysh, there's a new tribe now that's known as the Quraysh. Now remember, there are tribes and there are clans. A tribe is a giant family unit, and it's made up of certain clans, which are smaller families. So the big tribe of Quraysh manages to take over control of the city of Mecca, and their lineage is from Prophet Ismail. And this is very important because the Prophet is going to be coming from this tribe, and the tribe has a very important status in this area. Now, what do the Quraysh do? The Quraysh have a very special honor, not only in Mecca, but throughout the entire country of Arabia, the entire land of Arabia. What do? They are the caretakers of the Kaaba. They are the caretakers of the Kaaba. Now, why is that so important? It's so important because we have to understand what we were talking about before, that the Kaaba became a place where all the Arabs were coming from different parts of Arabia and even other lands, and they were coming to visit this area from the time of Prophet Ibrahim and passing on the generations. Even though idolatry has crept in, the Kaaba still serves as a very important place where most Arabs are still going during pilgrimage season. So what's happening over here? The Quraysh, now that they're in control of Mecca, they have the special status of being the caretakers of the Kaaba inside the city of Mecca, because they control that area. So what do they do? Okay, what do? They, for example, they feed the pilgrims who come. They're giving shelter to the pilgrims who are coming. They are holding separate festivals, what you can call like poetry festivals, trading festivals, bazaars, selling merchandise and selling goods. You know, the pilgrimage now is not only a religious ritual, that's a very important part of it now, even though it's corrupted by idolatry, but at the same time, this is, if everyone is gathering here, and Mecca is like a magnet which is attracting all different people, what do you get in the city? You get a very vibrant city at this point in time. So you have trade, you have commerce, you have arts are flourishing, poetry, and different things that people are publishing and all of that. It's a place of gathering for people. So it's like a major city, like New York or LA, where a lot of people are coming, but they're not always there throughout the year. They only come and they gather there at one particular time in the year. So Mecca becomes very prominent in the hearts of people, not always physically, but in the hearts of people, it's a very, very important thing. So what ends up happening is, if Quraysh are in control of Mecca, and everyone is going to Mecca at least once a year, they hold Mecca with a special dignity, with a special status. And that's always existed. Because whoever is in control of the Kaaba also gets the status. If they're serving the pilgrims, they get the status. So like today, for example, the modern day, you find that the kings and the princes, they always want to be the Khadimul Haramain. They want to be the servant of, you know, the holy sanctuary or these special places. Why? Because in the sight of people, they're also going to have a special status because of the status, you know, because of the help and support that they're giving to the people who are coming over here. So the Quraysh hold a very special place, a place of honor in the hearts and the minds of all the people throughout Arabia. So it's a very important clan. Now, keep in mind, it does not mean that the Quraysh are militarily superior or politically superior to the other tribes throughout Arabia. But religiously, despite their corruption in the religion, religiously, they are the superiors in the entire Arabian, you know, subcontinent, in the entire Arabian Peninsula. Okay? Now, within the tribe of Quraysh, you have one clan which is the most prominent. Now, how does this work, the most prominent clan? Well, there's many clans within a tribe, and they're always trying to compete with one another to see who comes on top. Imagine it's like the Democrats and the Republicans trying to compete who controls the House one day and who controls this other part another day. They're switching back and forth sometimes. And sometimes there's victories on this front, victories on that front. By this time, we're not talking about 5th century anymore. Now we're moving to the time where the Prophet ﷺ was born. So, which century are we talking about? 6th century, right? So 6th century, the clan of Hashim has become the most prominent clan, one of the most prominent clans in among Quraysh. By a narrow margin, but it's still one of the most prominent. And the leader of that clan is a man by the name of Abdul Muttalib. Okay, Abdul Muttalib is the leader of that clan, and since he's the leader of that clan and they're the most prominent tribe, he's become the leader of the Quraysh. So he's the leader of the entire tribe of Quraysh, and now you understand the position that Quraysh has within Arabia, so you understand how important this man is in the entire Arabian Peninsula. Right? Abdul Muttalib. And this is the grandfather of the Prophet. This is the grandfather of the Prophet. So he's the leader of Quraysh. Now he has several children. He has several children, and there's a lot of, you know, history about his children and how many children he had and how he got them and all of that. But the important thing is, one of his children, one of the younger ones, is named Abdullah, one of his sons, is named Abdullah. And in fact, he was one of the most beloved sons to his father. So his father used to care a lot for him. He was one of the favorite children of Abdul Muttalib. His name was Abdullah. So Abdullah marries a woman by the name of Amina. Okay? So both of them get married, and what ends up happening is, after they're married, they're very recently married, they have not been married for a very long time, while the father is on a journey, he's traveling somewhere, and in fact, historical sources say, he was traveling to the city of Yathrib, which is now known as the city of Medina. So he was traveling in that area, and he died on the way. He died on the way, and he left his wife pregnant. So Amina is pregnant. And this is the father and the mother of the Prophet Muhammad sallallahu alaihi wasallam. So we understand who his grandfather is. It's not just about knowing his name. It's about knowing his position. It's about knowing his status. It's about knowing the status of his father. It's about knowing the situation, what happened, why he died early, all of these things. So it's important to understand. So his wife is pregnant, okay? And then we're going to see how the Prophet ﷺ is born. Any questions on this slide so far? Okay, how did the descendants of Prophet Ismail come back to recapture?
Because yeah. They were gone.
They were gone. Yeah, so they were not too far. They were still in Arabia. So it's just a matter of conquering one city and taking over and all of these things. So they did not leave the entire, you know, peninsula. They were still in the area, yeah. No, sorry. Qusay is the name of the man who recaptured, and the tribe of Quraysh is sometimes attributed to him. He's a man from the tribe of Quraysh. Yeah, an important figure in the tribe of Quraysh. Okay? There's different theories of who started Quraysh and all of that. That's not too important. So who is Qusay? Qusay is a man who managed to recapture Mecca for the tribe of Quraysh, which he belongs to. So the question is, if the Arabs used to follow the religion of their ancestors, then why didn't they do the same thing when it came to Prophet Ismail? Okay, so a very good question. So the thing is that because of the long gap, they had lost the concept of what the real religion of Prophet Ismail was. So they didn't realize that, you know, see, when idolatry crept in over time, they forgot they kept the ritual, but they forgot the meaning behind the ritual, like we talked about last time. So if you keep the ritual and you forget the meaning, you think that's probably what Prophet Ismail was doing. And then if you introduce an idol and you say, well, Prophet Ismail, he didn't use an idol, that's true, but his intention was to get close to God, and we're only using these idols to get close to Allah, therefore he wouldn't have a problem with it. It's just like something that you just kind of add over time. It's like you know, modern technology, you know? The idol just kind of helps us get a little bit faster or something like that. So they didn't realize actually what the original teachings were. And if someone came and told them, they would try and reason it out and say, no, you know, that's probably not what he was really doing. You know, he probably was doing the same thing. So they never forsook the religion of their ancestors going back. They just misunderstood it. It was confused in their mind. So moving forward. So now, on a Monday in the month of Rabi al-Awwal, which is a month in the lunar calendar that they used to use at that time, in the year 570 CE, the Prophet ﷺ was born. And as I mentioned in your text, sometimes you will find that it's 571 CE. So why is there a discrepancy between 570 CE and 571 CE? Well, there's a number of reasons. One of the main reasons is we're talking about the Christian calendar here. And the Christian calendar, or the Western calendar, has undergone several changes. It's been replaced with Gregorian calendar and a Julian calendar, and days have been added from one church taking over, and some days have been removed. So there's been a corruption within the calendar. So converting causes a problem, number one. Number two, Arabs used to keep track of dates by certain important events that took place, and they were not that concerned with exact numbers and days, and this is exactly what happened and all of that. They would remember the day, they would remember the month, and in terms of the year, they didn't even have a yearly calculation system, right? But the main issue is, if we understand that by the time they calculated the number of years to which they started a calculation system, when you convert from an Islamic calendar to a Christian calendar, you're going to be off, because the people within the Christian calendar who have a solar calendar, they themselves don't have a specific criteria of exactly how to date events going back, because there's been so much discrepancy on how the calendar has changed over time. If you look at the history of calendars, history of the Gregorian calendar, history of the Julian calendar, you'll find all the discrepancies taking place, because every time another religious group took control, or another political group took control, they thought that they want to modify everything however they feel like. So that was a major problem with calendars and with datings. So he was born, we know, on a Monday. We know on a Monday for sure, and in the month of Rabi al-Awwal, which is very probable. And his name was Muhammad. So this child's name was Muhammad, which actually was a very rare name that was used at that time, but this was the name that was given to him. Sources suggest, you know, different reasons why he was given the name, but the name is the praised one. So Muhammad actually means the praised one. And it's important to understand that in Arabian culture, in Arabian society at that time, lineage and family history was something very, very important. People used to memorize their, you know, lineage going all the way back to so many different descendants and everything. So he came from a very, very noble family, because Prophet Ismail had a very noble position in the sight of Allah as well as in the sight of the Arabs, number one. Number two, he's coming from the tribe of Quraysh, as noble as you can get, right? One of the important tribes in Arabia. Number three, he's coming from the clan of Hashim, the most prominent clan that's there, right? And his ancestry goes all the way back to Prophet Ismail. Like I said, his 21st ancestor is named Adnan. And Adnan is one of the very prominent descendants of Prophet Ismail somewhere down the line. Tracing from Adnan back to Prophet Ismail there's a lot of conjecture involved. You can't really trust 100% how the lineage goes back. So we don't exactly know. But going from the Prophet, 21 people or 20 people up to Adnan, it's very clear. It's very clear, it's very well documented, and everyone knows how his lineage goes. Okay? You don't need to memorize the guy's name, Adnan, by the way. You're not going to be tested on that. But just so you understand how important lineage is in that society, and that he's coming from the lineage of Prophet Ismail. This is going to be very important, because from the time of Prophet Ismail going all the way down, he did not have any descendants that were prophets. But his brother Ishaq, you know, Ibrahim's other son, actually had several prophets going through. Prophet Musa, Prophet Moses, Prophet Jesus, Prophet Isa, all of them going through, he had several. Bani Israel and all of that line. So you'll find a difference here. So just know that important family. Now the Prophet ﷺ, he was raised in the desert. Now why was he raised in the desert? Because children who were from noble families, not all children, children who were from noble families were able to go and send their children into the desert to be raised. Okay, so he was taken into the desert and he was raised by a foster mother who we're going to talk about. Now why would children be raised in the desert? There's a number of reasons. Number of reasons. Number one, there's less disease. There was actually more, there's other illnesses outside in the desert as well, but in the city there are more disease because there's more people. And that can constitute a lot of disease. So there was less disease, number one. Number two, the language is more pure. The language is pure outside in the desert, which is kind of, you know, some, it depends, you know, like if you look in the inner city, language has been changed, right? In a major city, in the inner city, language changes into Ebonics and different, you know, colloquial type of things and all of that. So it's very different. The pure language, the most eloquent language has been maintained in the desert because Arabs prided themselves on their language and on their poetry. And people who were in the desert, they used to, you know, compose a lot of poetry. Number three, to make them tougher. You see, they actually wanted their children to become a little bit tough because they grew up to be stronger. If you grew up in the palace, right, and you're spoiled by all the, you know, maid servants and all of that, you're going to end up growing to be, you know, I mean, not necessarily, but it's more likely that you're going to kind of grow up as a wimp. You know, so this actually continued, this tradition continued after the demise of the Prophet ﷺ, and many of the khulafa, many of the leaders of the Muslim ummah, they used to be raised up in the desert. Even their children were raised up. And it's a funny story in one of the books that I came across. They said, you know, the first khalifa, the first ruler of the Muslim world, who actually their parents decided not to put them in the desert, he happened to be the biggest wimp out of all the khalifas that actually ended up. So you can see that in some books of Sirah, they talk about that. There's less vices. There are less vices out in the desert than there are in the city. Now if you think about that, that's the way cities still are today. More vices, more immorality, more things going on because more people, more, you know, self-interest, more economics, more greed, more all of these things. So more vices end up being in the city, right? Like having like clubs and drinking and all of these things. Outside in the desert, it's just kind of, you know, you may do some bad stuff, but it's not that organized. So the Prophet ﷺ, he grew up in the desert and Halima was his foster mother. And she's the one who came him and took him out into the desert, and he was raised over there. Now when it says that he was raised over there, does it mean that he was separated from his family? No, that would be a misconception. It means that he used to be taken back to visit his mother on a regular basis, right? But he would generally be living outside in the desert. It was not far. We're not talking about all the way in the other side of the desert. We're just talking about a little bit outside the city, in the desert with the nomads who would be traveling around from place to place. And later on, after a few years, we don't know exactly how many years, maybe 3-4 years, something like that, he was returned to his mother. Because it's only during a certain period of infancy and early childhood that they're raised in the desert. So he was returned back to his mother, and the Prophet was, we already talked about that. So he later returned to his mother. Now mother and child are reunited once again. Okay? Any questions on this? Good question. So were the Arabs aware that they had vices in their own community by drinking and gambling and prostitution, all of that? Yes, they did. And when we talk about the rebuilding of the Kaaba, we're going to find their conception, they had a conception of what is right and wrong to some extent. We're gonna find that in that instance. Another good question. So how would these vices within the city affect a young child when they're only spending the first few years of their life in the desert? So the thing is, when people grow up, you know, even kids who are 3 and 4 years old, they observe things around them, and the things around them affects them as well. So if they're raised, for example, imagine your father goes and constantly decides, you know what, instead of taking you out to show you how he goes hunting or to show you how he goes and collects water, he takes you to the nightclub or he takes you to the casino. It has an effect on a young child. the stuff that he's watching and the stuff that he's seeing and all of these things. So it has an effect to an extent. Maybe the vices is not the only, maybe it was not the reason why they were sending their kids out. We're just saying that that's one of the benefits that he gets. That not necessarily that they did it for that particular reason. Right? So there's a difference between their intention and some of the wisdom that we can see in the way that he was brought up. So the Prophet ﷺ, at the age of six, he already lost his father. Now at the age of six, his mother was traveling on a journey with him, and she passed away. And she died, and he, you know, during the journey, and one of her, you know, workers or servants took him back to Mecca safely. But now he's lost mother, and he's lost father. He's a full orphan now. Before he was a half, he's still considered to be an orphan when you lose your father, because that's your main source of, you know, support, financial support, lively support, and all of that. Now he's lost his mother as well. So it's a very difficult thing to encounter these type of things, and you're going to understand how this affects the type of person he is when he's dealing with orphans in the future, or when he's doing certain things. But his grandfather, all right, who is his grandfather? Abdul Muttalib, we just talked about. His grandfather takes charge of him and says, I will take care of him like one of my own children. Okay? So now, in whose custody is the Prophet ﷺ growing up right now? One of the most important people in the entire peninsula of Arabia. So we're not talking about some small family here. We're talking about a very, very important personality in the entire area. Right? Now, he used to take such good care of him that he had his own kids sitting around when they used to meet. They used to meet in front of the Kaaba because he's the chief, right? He's the chief of the tribe. So they used to meet in front of the Kaaba and they used to sit down, and they used to sit down in like a circle or a semicircle or whatever it may be. And his kids used to sit around as well during some of these gatherings. But there was a special seat which he would sit on, because that's his special chair because he's the chief. And he would only let young Muhammad sit on the same chair along with him, next to him. Which shows you the kind of respect and the kind of treatment that he was getting. Now, why is that important? Why are these details important? These details are important because people try to make accusations against the Prophet when they go back to his early life. And they say, well, since his mother and father died, he must have had so much bad trauma that he has been abused all of his life, and therefore he ended up like this. Okay? Now, to debunk that theory, you simply look at how did his grandfather take care of him? Better than his own children. So you have one of the most important people in Arabia giving you the special seat next to you that your own kids wouldn't even have. Special treatment. And then if you go and you make another theory and you say, well, he was raised spoiled and he had this and he had that. You say, yes, okay, you zoomed in on a few years of his life. He had a great thing. But he did lose his mother and father. He was raised in the desert on top of that. That theory is also thrown out of the water. Because remember what I mentioned to you in the introduction, is that this is what people are doing. When they try to attack the life of the Prophet, they go and they look at these certain details and they zoom in on one event and they make a giant story out of it. He lost his father, so he was traumatized and he needed social, you know, care, and therefore he came up with this message of the Quran somehow. Or they say, no, he was raised as a king and he just wanted to reclaim leadership, and therefore he came with the Quran in order to reclaim leadership. You're going to find this stuff all in so many books, because today, you know, writing a book about the Prophet is one of the most, or about Islam or about the Prophet, is one of the most lucrative professions that you can get into. Because you just put a bunch of propaganda on it and you sell it and it sells. And it becomes like a New York Times bestseller. You sell a million copies and you're a millionaire now. So this is happening. We have even taking small aspects of the facts about his life can be used to understand what his upbringing was really like. So these are important things. These are not just kind of random things. But don't just focus on names and places. Focus on how you can utilize this information to understand what his upbringing was really like. Okay, so at the age of eight, his grandfather Abdul Muttalib also passes away. So he lost another person. So he's lost another caretaker. Now his uncle Abu Talib takes care of him. So his uncle Abu Talib, who's one of the prominent people in the Quraysh, tribe of Quraysh as well. He's one of the very prominent people, but he's not the most prominent. So after Abdul Muttalib passes away, there is kind of like, since he had a lot of children, there is kind of like a struggle for power, you know, unspoken struggle for power. Who's going to take the position of Abdul Muttalib? Because some leaders have that strength, right? They have that, you know, they have that aura about them. When they pass away and there's, you kind of think, oh, the eldest one might take charge or this one might take charge. Sometimes none of the children have the same leadership characteristics as the father. So they say, which one is going to take over? They're not exactly sure. So there's kind of like a little rivalry here kind of going on back and forth, but the tribe is still okay. So his uncle Abu Talib was one of them, not the most prominent, but he was one of the, you know, important chieftains as well. He takes charge and he takes the Prophet into his household and he says, I will adopt you and you're going to be like my son. So he was very, very close. Now Abu Talib loved him very, very much. Just like his grandfather did, Abu Talib loved him and he treated him like his own child. In fact, when he would travel, sometimes he would take the Prophet on his journeys, when he goes on business or something, even when he didn't take some of his own children. So he kept him very close and very near, and he was very dear to him. So he had a very, it's not, even though he lost his mother and father, he still had a very loving upbringing. So it's not that he didn't have love in his life, and it's not that he had trauma or something like that. If you're this cared for, there's a different background story. Now the Prophet ﷺ, keep in mind that Abu Talib was not that wealthy. His uncle was not that wealthy like the other brothers were, and like Abdul Muttalib was because he was the chief. So he was maybe not doing so well in his business. And there was a famine, he lost a lot of property and everything. So the Prophet ﷺ, what did he do? He had to go and earn his own living. So he had to earn his own living. So he did not have everything on a golden platter, as they say, you know, just given to him because he's from the nobility. He had to go and work. And when he was working, he took shepherding as a profession. So he became a shepherd, meaning you have to take care of sheep and you take care of goats and you have to guide them and, you know, you're kind of on the outskirts of the city. And it's a profession. Now, he's taking care of these sheep. Now, what are the benefits of being a shepherd? Understanding that, you know, your profession kind of has an impact on the way that you think, your upbringing, the way that you behave and all of that. What are some of the benefits of being a shepherd? Well, number one, you learn how to guide animals, which will actually teach you how to guide people. It teaches you a very important skill because when the sheep are going this way, you have to kind of, you know, guide them and kind of keep them all together. If they start running this way, you have to figure out a way to kind of bring them back. So it teaches you a very important quality in life, very skill in life, is how to guide. And this can be applied to different people, it can be applied to different animals, it can be applied to children, it can be applied to a lot of things. Number two, you learn to protect and care for them. Right? Because your job is to make sure that not a single one of these sheep or not a single one of these goats gets injured or gets harmed in any way. So you're taking care of them. So his sense of, his awareness of caution, his awareness of care for other animals here will apply to other people as well. So this is a very important lessons that are there. What other lessons are there? You learn patience. You learn patience. Right? So when you go outside and you have a bunch of sheep and they, you know, they need to eat and they need to feed, you can't just say, you know what, look, I got another appointment. You know, I need to go. I don't have time for you. So hurry up and eat the food and I need to go and make my other appointment. No, they're going to eat whenever they want to eat. Right? They're going to take their time. And if one of them is going slow, you have to wait for them. You can't just say, look, I don't have time for you. You know, just wait there and I'll be back. And you can't take a vacation. You can't just tell your sheep, you know, and say, you know what, you know, it's Saturday and it's my day off now. So I'm just going to leave you. And don't move, and I'll be back tomorrow when I'm working again. You can't do that. So it's very important to understand the profession that he's getting into, and it gives you a sense, time to reflect. Very, very important. It gives you time to reflect because you're spending time outside the city, outside of people. You know, when people are so much around people all the time, and they're just talking, socializing, they don't get time to reflect in their life. If they're just entertaining themselves with something to death, they don't have time. So he's outside, he's just with the animals, he's with the nature, he's outside by himself, he gets time to reflect, and he gets time to think about life and about all of these other things. So these are some of the things. And why it's so important, the profession of shepherding, is because most prophets were shepherds throughout history. And that's very interesting. And the Prophet ﷺ, he himself said that later on in life. He said that most, or he said all, meaning most, prophets were shepherds throughout their life. Now, why would all the prophets have to go through this kind of training? It's a training for their prophethood. So it's very important to understand, you know, how someone's occupation will affect their life and affect certain skills. Like if you're a butcher and you're just slaughtering all the time and you're seeing blood all the time, it has an effect on your psyche to an extent. It doesn't mean that you're disadvantaged, but it has a different effect. All right? If you're dealing with people who are, you know, emergency victims who are being traumatized, it has an effect on your psyche as well. You know, if you're a soldier, it has an effect. So all of these things have an effect. So being a shepherd is something which teaches you a lot of responsibility, a lot of care, and these type of things. Any questions on this? What's the closest profession to being a shepherd in today's society? First of all, it doesn't mean that we have to go and become shepherds, right? It just means that you have to understand how your profession affects you, and if there's negative effects, you need to be careful of them. And if there are positive effects, you need to utilize those positive benefits for the sake of something good, rather than just wasting it. That's really what it is. So today's shepherding, maybe taking care of, maybe being in charge of a nursery or something like that, you know, taking care of children or something, I don't know. I don't know. A what? A taxi driver? Driving a taxi? No, I wouldn't think so. No. That's more like if he was in charge of a caravan, like giving people rides across, you know, something like that. No, I don't think so. But anyway, so it doesn't mean that you have to become a shepherd or something. Understand how your profession affects you and understand how the profession of the prophets affected them. It's important to understand that, okay? Any other questions? Yeah, so the story about the, you know, splitting of the heart when he was with Halima and all of that, yeah, there's an authentic narration regarding that. Yeah, so that is there. The reason why I didn't mention it is because, it's a long story, but the reason why I didn't mention it is because scholars differ whether it actually took place at this time or whether it took place at another time in history, which was during the Isra. Right? So it's very difficult to pinpoint exactly which one happened or it happened twice. So there's actually three different opinions on the matter, and because there's difference of opinion, I decided to just leave it out for the sake of consensus. That's the reason. The next important event that took place in the life of the Prophet was a coalition to protect the weak. Okay, this is known as Hilf al-Fudul. Okay, it's a very important event. Now, understand the context of it. We're talking about a tribal society. Tribalism is rampant, which means that many crimes will either go unpunished or they will just be, you know, they'll just be sidelined. Because when you live in a tribal society, what happens? Your tribe is right. The other tribe is wrong. Even if you're wrong, you still support your tribe no matter what. That's the way it works, right? It's like an extreme form of nationalism. My country, right or wrong. Whatever my country does, that's the way it's going to be. We always support my country no matter what. It's the same form of old-style tribalism. So the same thing's happening. This, in Arabia, this is the system that existed at that time. Unfortunately, some, you know, countries are trying to, you know, bring that back. You know, may Allah protect us from that. But this is what used to happen, even in Arabia. So, in Mecca, one incident took place where a Yemeni merchant, we saw where Yemen was, right? Where was Yemen? North, east, west? South. Good, mashallah. Alright, so you'll see some curveballs coming, right? So, a Yemeni merchant from the south of Arabia, he went up and he visited Mecca. Now, why would he be visiting Mecca? Because everybody visits Mecca, right? It's the place of pilgrimage. So he's probably visiting Mecca at one time, and he brings some merchandise from southern Arabia, because there's good merchandise there. The good merchandise is in the south, good merchandise is in the north, in the area of Syria. This is where the main caravan trades were going back and forth. So this Yemeni merchant brought some stuff to Mecca, and he's trying to sell it, and one man by the name of Al-As ibn Wa'il, he goes and he buys his merchandise. And he gets all the merchandise and everything, and he forgets to do one thing. He forgets to pay. And he says, "You're not getting any money." And he says, "You took my merchandise." He said, "Well, that's too bad. That's too bad. Sorry, there's nothing we can do about it." Now understand this. Why can a man like Al-As ibn Wa'il get away with this? Number one, yes, what was it? No centralized government. One, no centralized government. Number two, he was of a higher status. He's from an important family. He's from a top family. And number three, so he's from a tribe, high family, so the tribe is supporting him. That's right. And number three? Go ahead. He's an outsider. Exactly. He's an outsider. So if you're an outsider, where's your tribe? You may have the tribe back home, but you don't got the tribe in Mecca. So who's going to back you up? It's like a gang. It's like one guy from a gang went into another gang's territory. Now what are you going to do? You're by yourself. You know, you can't stop me. I got my entire clan to back me up. So there's nothing you can do. So he's been wronged. Okay? Now what ends up happening? This is one incident that kind of changed things, right? So what ends up happening? Some of the people, this man goes and he starts reciting poetry. I've been wronged, and you know, what kind of people are you? And you know, you people of Quraysh, you're supposed to be the religious people, you know, giving them the guilt trip, you know? You people, and you know, I come to Mecca, this is the holy place, and you guys rip me off, and you no one does anything, and you just stand by. And, but he put it with eloquence, right? It shows you the effect of the arts, right, upon a population. Very important. If he just said, you know, who's going to help me? No one's going to help me. If you articulate it in a very, you know, intelligent way, more people are likely to respond. Important lesson to learn. But at the same time, so some people, he got the sympathy of some people, some important people, and they started feeling bad. So they gathered together and they said, you know what? We shouldn't allow this to take place. We should do something about this, because this is we know it's not right, but our reputation on top of that is going to be hurt. This is, something is wrong. We should do something about it. So another thing, so what did they do? They made a pact. Okay? Now there's two reasons why they got together. One is because they felt sorry for the guy, number one. Number two, they had just come out of a major war. Very important part. They had come out of a major war, and that's, it's somewhere here, I believe. It's in your book. So they had recently come out of a major war. Now what happens when you come out of war? You remember what all that war was about. You remember people dying. You remember people being hurt. You remember, you know, you're thinking, was this all worth it for nothing? And this is something important, because when you look at history, for example, you look at, for the most part, Europe's stance to war today. Why do you find that it's very different from America's stance on war? It's because they witnessed World War II right there on their soil. They witnessed and they remember the bombs falling. The people who are still alive over there, they remember the chaos and the destruction and everything. Whereas America has not been attacked since when? Pearl Harbor was not mainland. The mainland American soil. Outside of 9/11, outside of 9/11. A real attack from a real, you know, organized group. Huh? A foreign power. Of course it did. It's the last one. Raise your hand if you really think you know. Yeah. War of 1812, okay? Last time that they were attacked was the War of 1812. Okay, so it's a very different scenario when you have war in your land and you just come out of war. There follows generally a good time of peace, because people keep it in their mind. This is exactly what happened to the Arabs here. Exactly what happened. They just came from a major war, and they know this war was for nothing. It was just over foolishness. So they are more inclined to say, you know what? We don't want to have more wars. This is unjust. So their sense of justice is a little bit heightened at this time. And they get together, and they go and they meet in one of the leader's house, his houses. His name is Abdullah ibn Jud'an, not important. But each leader comes together and they say, we will stand for justice. This is the only way it's going to work. Because if you have the leaders willing to commit and saying, we're not going to allow this man to oppress, we're not going to allow this man to continue, we're going to stand up for what's right, and we're going to sign this document, and we all agree that we collectively go to him and say, it doesn't matter if your tribe backs you up, we're going to go against your whole tribe. When you got five clans going and saying, your one clan, yes, we'll back you up, but we got five clans putting pressure on you, that clan backs down. That's the way the politics used to work over here. It's important to understand politics, how it works. Especially here, because you understand the reaction to the message and the mission. So they make this pact called the Pact of Excellence, the Hilf al-Fudul, and they forced Al-As ibn Wa'il to return the merchandise because he still didn't want to pay for it. So they forced him to return the merchandise to the man, and this was a very successful thing. Now, what is the most important thing about this for our class? The most important thing about this is that the Prophet, before he was a prophet, Muhammad was there, sallallahu alaihi wasallam, and he took part, he was in the house, and he took part in the pact. What does that tell you? How many people do you think were in the house of the leader? His house is not that big, right? That he was respected, that he was considered a major, like not a major, but he was considered someone important enough to invite here because he's a person who stands up for justice, and he had a little bit of status because of his uncle. Very important. So it shows you his reputation, and he used to say later on in life, even after he became a prophet, he used to praise this pact all the time. And he says, you know, if someone asked me to participate in this kind of pact, even with Islam now, I would participate. I wouldn't sacrifice anything, I would participate in that. What does that tell you? It tells you that even if after he's a prophet, he's remembering this pact, and he's praising it, and saying how great it was, and he would love to participate in it. How many Muslims were in this group? Zero, right? Outside of the prophet, because he didn't worship idols, zero. Which means that participating in a pact, or participating in an agreement, or participating in a movement with a group of people who you completely disagree with on the most fundamental levels is still praiseworthy in and of itself, as long as the actual actions that you're doing is praiseworthy. As long as the status and the substance of what you're trying to achieve has some benefit behind it. So in very important life, and it shows you his reputation. It shows you the type of reputation that he had at that time, and more important, it shows you his sense of justice, even before he was a prophet. Okay? So his reputation. So the reputation of the Prophet ﷺ before he was a prophet is very important. Number one, he used to refuse to worship idols. Okay? So he was one of the few people in Arabia, or few people in Mecca in particular, who refused. There's a difference between not worshipping idols and refusing to worship idols. And I hope we understand the difference, right? So, there's those people who just weren't exposed to it. So, they say, they just didn't do it. He was averse, since he was young, to worshipping idols, because that's something that Allah had prepared him for. And one of the ways in which he used to do, when he was, people were performing the, you know, circumambulation of the Kaaba. We said, you know, you go around the Kaaba, and that we talked about the meaning behind that. He used to go around, and everyone at that time had a, there was a certain idol which they would touch while they were going around. And he used to be one of the people who skipped that idol. So even while doing that, even though he didn't worship, he didn't even touch the idol. Which means that even outwardly, he didn't want to show any signs of idol worship. Although he was not telling anybody else to stop. He did not tell anyone else, you shouldn't touch the idol. It was just something he himself used to do. Okay? He didn't eat meat that was dedicated to the idols. Even this is before he was a prophet. He did not used to eat meat that used to be dedicated to certain idols. So what used to end up happening was they used to slaughter an animal in the name of the idol. And then they would distribute the meat, and it's supposed to be like holy meat or something like that. And this is like one of their sacrifices that they give to the idols and all of that. He used to not participate and not eat that meat, and he says, I don't like this. I don't like this meat. You give me some other meat, I'll eat it. But this one, I'm not going to eat it. He never protested openly though. This is a very, very important point to understand, is that these are things that he used to do, people observed in him, but he did not start a mission. He did not start going and telling other people, you shouldn't do this, because he was not a prophet at that time. He was not a prophet at that time. And there are other reasons why it's important. We'll talk about that. So what ended up happening a little bit later, after he was a shepherd, he collected some money, he's been helping his uncle out, it's time to move up in the world of business. So he becomes a businessman. So he didn't just stay stagnant in being a shepherd, he moved up, he became a businessman, which is generally considered in that society to be a little bit better profession. So he's a businessman, but he didn't have that much capital. So what did he used to do? He used to trade for other people. It's called mudaraba. You don't need to know the term. It's where somebody else invests, gives you the investment, and you take their money and you trade it for them, and you give them, you keep a percentage, and you give them back, you know, their investment plus a percentage. So this is the type of trading he used to do. It doesn't mean that he owned a large inventory, you know, and he had like a lot of stuff and he's going and selling that. No, it doesn't mean that. So he used to trade on behalf of other people. And he was very, very honest at this time. So when he became, he was already known to be honest, but now that he's a businessman, he's a trader, he's going and he's earning himself a reputation within society. Without even, you know, intentionally doing it, because he was so honest when it came to business. Now, there's a difference between being in a society which is extremely corrupt and you being one of the, you know, people, you know, oddballs out. And there's a difference between being in a society where there are corrupt people, there are good people, but you're the exceptional person. That's what Arabian society was at that time. These were not people who were just ripping off everyone because they would have the worst reputation. They had a reputation as the religious people in Mecca. So they were not going and ripping off people on a regular basis. So there were some people probably rip others off. There are those who were doing their job, making money. And then he stood out from all of them with something above and beyond that people had never seen before. And they saw that this man, he's so honest to such an extent that people used to come and take their valuables and they used to deposit with him. He's like a living bank now. A living bank which does not charge any interest, right? Or does not collect any interest, right? So they go and they say, we want you to keep this for us, or we want you to take care of this for us. And he would go ahead and keep it. Why? Because they know for sure this is the only guy we've ever met where we have so much 100% confidence in him, he'd never do anything. He would never take our money, he would never do anything. Shows you even before prophethood how he was. Important status in society. Now he had very high morals as well. When I say high morals, I don't just mean from Arabian perspective, from, you know, a more universal perspective. His morals were, he was never known ever to drink wine. Everyone in the society was drinking wine, getting drunk, getting intoxicated, doing other kind of things, whatever they do. Even a social casual drinking, he was not doing any of that. He was not doing any of that. Number two, he was never known to commit adultery. So he did not have any relationships with any woman outside during this time. Very, very important to understand, because this was a society where we talked about how prostitution worked. He was never visiting a prostitute. He was never committing adultery. He was never with anybody else. Very important to understand. He was not gambling. He was not doing any of these things. Okay? So these were the high morals and the status that he had at this time. And then we're going to see what his status leads to and how it helps him to get married. Okay? Any questions on this slide? So good question. So how is it that he started... You know, how is it that he refused to worship idols at a young age when he's in a society where everyone else is doing it? It could be either one of two things or a combination of both. Either Allah came and, you know, sent an angel or revealed something to him. There are some reports to that effect, but they're not that strong. That kind of told him to stay away from these things. That's one. Number two, because he was going to be a prophet and Allah knew that he was going to be a prophet. Number two, he had an intelligence. And he realized while he was young, like Prophet Ibrahim, if you know the story, he realized while he was young that something is wrong with this idol worship. So most likely it's probably more of the second reason, that he figured out on his own that this idol can't do anything for me. So he used to refuse, but at the same time, he was not in the habit, or he was not thinking about going and telling other people. This was just something that he was just kind of doing on his own. And this is something that, for example, a lot of people who grow up among idolatry or among different religions that teach different things, there are always a few kids who grow up and they know something is wrong with this. And they don't talk to anybody about it, but they know what the other people are doing is wrong. There are many people like that. So he's definitely, most probably, that's how he did it. It's one of, you know, that's how, one of the ways he got to it. Good question. Yeah, so the question is there a story where he was going to go to like one of these nightclub type of... It was actually, he was going to a wedding, right? And they're going to have like drinking and dancing and partying and all of that, and he fell asleep and everything. There is a report to that effect, but the report is slightly weak. Slightly weak. Yeah, so the thing is, remember, the methodology that we're using is that that report says that he was divinely inspired to fall asleep. And then he woke. He went there. He fell asleep, and then he woke up, and the party was over. So he didn't engage in the party at all. Now the thing is, because he was divinely inspired, If we're talking about something that's connected to the religion, we want to use more rigorously authenticated sources. That's why it's not mentioned in this book. Before he became a prophet, what was his religion? Hanif, yeah. We're going to explain what that means. Okay, was his family Hanif as well? Not likely. Okay. Will they be judged? That's another issue. But were they practicing the oneness of God? Not worshiping idols? Not likely. Any other questions? Okay. So, should we take a break, or are we going to skip the break completely? Should take a break now? Okay, inshallah. So, 10-minute break. It's 8:52. We'll resume at 9:52, inshallah. Assalamu alaikum.